Today I have an interesting dilemma. And actually it's a dilemma that I think is quite prominent nowadays amongst people who do things similar to what I do. Yesterday I received some sample books because I receive every now and then books from publishers that I usually review and check if they're good for publication in Russia, in Russian language. I've been doing this now for many years, maybe 7 years or something like that. And we usually worked with different publishers. One of them was a very, very big publisher. They were probably the largest in America, publishing alternative titles, which have become commonly known as New Age titles. And so I've been using a lot of their materials. I've been receiving lots of their books. Actually, we're talking about hundreds of their books from this one particular publisher. And I've noticed over the years that although they had started out, well, at least to a majority extent, publishing a wide variety of books of different subjects, all which fit within the New Age, quote-unquote, category. As time went on, they started becoming very specialized, or rather, their inclination of which books to publish have turned towards a specific field which is not at all New Age, but which is a tradition that goes from practically time immemorial, a very, very ancient kind of a tradition. So that has made me wonder. It was one of the things that made me wonder, made me consider. And then I received other books from another company that we had relationship with. And I have seen consistently that their books are not very good, that they have quite a mediocre quality to them. And I started more understanding about what's happening in the field of esoteria, or rather specifically, the field of the New Age. Now, I use this term New Age, not loosely. So I use this term New Age in the sense of those kind of topics, those kind of that form of knowledge, which is related to things which are of the alternative nature, which are dealing with the way we can develop ourselves as people, the way we can develop ourselves spiritually, the way that spiritual knowledge relates specifically to various etheric energies or esoteric techniques which have been modified to fit the modern audience. So we have New Age being a kind of a mixture of psychology. A lot of it borrows from either Jung or Abraham Maslow. Maslow, actually, you know, he's the most quoted psychologist in the world. We know, of course, about Freud. We know about Jung. These are very famous names, but very few people, unless they're in the field of psychology, know about Maslow. Yet he's the most quoted psychologist in the whole world, the most quoted author of psychological texts in the whole world. So we find that much of this New Age, so to speak, knowledge, and I have no problem with the term New Age. It's fine with me. I think New Ages are just a fact of life, nothing you can do about it. And to say something is helping to usher in a new era is quite fine with me. That whichever whatever that helps to make the new era work, the new times to work better is fine with me. But a lot of the basis of this, what is known as New Age nowadays, is really on taking responsibility for yourself, accepting what you are, coming in contact with your feelings, understanding the way your feelings relate to your life, the way they relate to others, and so on. A lot of this is based, again, on these, mainly two authors, Jung and Maslow. Sometimes there's a lot of it coming from others, but that depends on the particular discipline. Obviously, Madame Blavatsky had an enormous amount of influence on what happened in the development of esoteric philosophy. Annie Besant, of course, also contributed enormously to esoteric philosophy, and so on. I mean, there are many. I couldn't possibly speak about all of them. Now, there are other ways in which this kind of new form of discussion has manifested, but it borrows heavily from Buddhistic, Tibetan forms of wisdom and the Hindu forms of yoga and ideas. And that has been complemented by Western forms of mysticism, especially in terms of how people can use mystical processes and techniques which are known through the Kabbalah or known through Christian mysticism or known through any form of mysticism that has had its roots in modern religious tendencies. So now we see this interesting kind of a combination of knowledge, which has, to a large extent, become homogeneous. Now, if I were to listen to all of these different sources of knowledge, one would think that the New Age publications would follow in the footsteps of the founders of these particular forms of knowledge and simply amplify it. Well, we do find that to a certain extent. Yet, we find that these schools of thought remain quite distinct from other schools of thought and have a very kind of, let's say, specific clientele or group of followers or group of people who like the philosophy. There are still those who are theosophists, not as many as before. There are still those who are very closely connected with Edgar Cayce's way of presenting things. There are a lot of people who follow Daskalos and the interface between Orthodox Christian mysticism and the meditative techniques that he brought out. You'll find people who follow the pathwork kind of a methodology. Those who are following Eva Pierikos and her husband started the Core Energetics and other. She was basically the first one to do channeling and all kinds of stuff. There are, of course, there's hundreds of groups, and they maintain their distinct identity. Yet these groups, their literatures are not selling big time. They sell to those people who are interested in what they say, and people from other groups may buy a book of theirs here or there, but they themselves are not very incredibly well known in the sense of broad stream literatures. You have to go out of your way to find them or order them specifically. I would compare that to, just so that you understand what I'm talking about, I would compare that to like New Age literatures which are coming from a New Age publishing house, which are very broad-based. Like, for example, Conversations with God is one of the primary New Age type literatures. It's a very broad-based literature. It doesn't specifically fit within any school or discipline. It's kind of something which is meant for everybody. There are piles of other books, too numerous to mention, all within that category, which all are well written, capture the imagination of everybody who's, of course, inclined, and don't specifically cause one to move in any particular discipline or particular direction, don't require any allegiance or dedication to particular individuals, and which are very closely aligned to independence and individuality as being the primary motivating factor to embrace that oneness which we all are part of, and so on. Now, this has worked for quite some time. And interestingly enough, this methodology by which people have come to understand what this New Age philosophy is, I feel is somehow satiated. I feel the market is satiated to a certain extent. I feel that the literatures that are being produced do not have any kind of originality to them anymore. It is very hard to find new titles which say something specifically interesting. It's almost as if everybody has run out of steam. I'll give you an analogy. Like in the stock market, when there's a particular trend, maybe 3 years ago, energy was not a very big growth item. It was a very kind of stable item. Had its ups and downs, the energy market, but it wasn't considered a big growth item. But then it started to gradually increase and steadily kept its increase. And it wasn't until it was fairly developed as a market, in the sense that it had proven that it was a real growth, it wasn't until that point that a lot of people started thinking about it. It was spoken about in the common magazines. It was being announced everywhere as a goodbye, something that you should get. And this made it a very interesting buy for people. So they started immediately jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak, saying, yes, I want that too. Yes, I want to be part of that too. But as any analyst can tell you, by the time you hear about a hot stock pick, it's already too late. If you heard about it, that means everybody heard about it. And everybody's jumping into it. And that dilutes the value of it as a growth item. That doesn't mean it destroys it, but it dilutes it enormously. But for those who bought in at the very beginning, they gained enormously. The same thing I would say relates to this New Age kind of a market. Don't forget, like Conversations with God is from like 1992. If you look at what the same person is doing now, it's very uninteresting. He's changed, he's transformed as a person. He's not the same person who wrote those books. He has become affected by his wealth, affected by his power. So therefore, we see nothing specifically unique coming from this person anymore. I've seen also others who have written many books. Yet every book they come out with, they simply write like one or two chapters, and then they cut and paste from all the other books they've written, and in this way assemble a quote-unquote new book, which actually is not very new at all. They just change a few words in different chapters and say the same thing over and over again. Then we have other people who are writing so-called original titles, who are simply repeating everything that has been discussed before and throwing in some of their personal experience. And sometimes you might say, find that their personal experience is not even very interesting. Or it's just their way of saying something which you've already heard many times before. So after a while you realize there is a certain trend here. And that certain trend, I feel, has indicated that this New Age thing is basically dead. It just takes a while for everybody to figure it out. I saw this also in around 1970. Of course, some of you weren't even born in 1970. And all kinds of great power to you, because that's a wonderful thing to say. I wasn't even born in 1970. But in 1970, an amazing era had ended. We see the way in which music had transformed. We see the way in which a kind of new way of seeing the world arose, a way in which people were rebelling, so to speak, against the standards of their fathers and mothers, in which they were striving to come up with something which would actually modify the world and make it right. And music, of course, drugs and rock and roll, everybody talks about drugs, sex, and rock and roll. These were like the most important things in the 60s, late 60s, we're talking especially. Because by like 1970, everybody had figured out that it was kind of cool to be into drugs, sex, and rock and roll. So that which was in the beginning of the era, say 65, 66, very new, important, very interesting, transformed when everybody jumped on the bandwagon, when it became a popular thing, when big news magazines started publicizing it, when it became something which was popular. At that time, what happened at that time when it became popular is it became, again, diluted. Diluted in the sense that anybody and everybody could be part of it. Anybody and everybody could find their way into it. It wasn't so exclusive anymore. And when it wasn't so exclusive anymore, it lost its particular idealism, because it became diluted with an enormous multiplicity of ideas which transformed, at least for those who felt that it had some potential to change things or had some potential to do something fabulous, it was transformed and it started to become different. It started to fade away. There was this incident where Hell's Angels had murdered some people at a festival, which caused like the festival scene to just wither. Hell's Angels is a motorcycle gang. And after that, that caused like a shockwave throughout the festival scene, that reality set in. There was the death of Jimi Hendrix. There was the death of Janis Joplin. There were problems which people just couldn't deal with anymore, the way in which their minds had become ruined by their lifestyles. A lot of lack of motivation that people had. Enormous dissatisfaction with the war. Enormous dissatisfaction with the government. That whole movement just died out. But it was 1970 which nailed the end to it. But very few people thought like that at 1970. They were thinking like, well, we'll get it together. It's, you know, we'll just modify it a little bit. But actually it nailed the end of that era. I see that happening right now with this New Age thing. And I see that the way in which the books, the way in which the publications move, reflect that. It's actually turning into something which is a repetition. Or rather, one would say the same old thing in different packages. Almost as if you would take a cucumber and put it in a red package and a blue package, cut it into pieces and offer it this way and slice it that way and offer it that way. Essentially, you're dealing with a cucumber. So now, why this has been a relevant understanding to me is that, as you know, I go through my usual Friday evening, Saturday morning. What am I going to talk about? That's my particular difficulty. What am I going to talk about? And in the light of these books that were sent to me as samples, in the light of my understanding of the difficulty, even of these authors who are sincere, to come up with something actually interesting, I realized I have the exact same problem. At one point, when you discuss things every week, or you discuss things in a book format regularly, because what I might say in one Saturday broadcast might fill a chapter or three quarters of a chapter of a book. I don't know. But you can imagine these people, they have to put out a book every 6 months or every year just so that they can live, and then they have to go out and lecture about it and do workshops about it and so on. So I very much feel an empathy for them, because I'm in the same situation. In other words, what topic should I talk about now? What specific thing should I speak about? Is there something to reveal? Is there something unique here? Is there something interesting that my audience will like? The way I've been really dealing with this is I've only been discussing that which has been relevant to me as a person in the previous week. In other words, I was having an honest talk, kind of like a broadcast therapy session, about things I've thought about, things I've realized in my common everyday life, which may or may not have any value to others, but which I understood very well because they were part of my life. This week, I tried to do the same thing, but what was part of my life last week was, honestly speaking, what is the reason I do what I do? Honestly speaking, why do I sit here on Saturday and talk? If I have to struggle to come up with a topic that might interest people, I'm going to run out of topics. If you think about it, I'm practically broadcasting at least 50 weeks out of the year. That means 50 unique kind of things to talk about. Now, we have been doing this now regularly every Saturday for more than 2 years. Almost 2.5 years now this has been going on. So we're talking about maybe 120 specifically unique things to talk about. Now, after you've talked about 120 specifically unique items, you will realize that there's a lot of duplication. Last week we talked about community. And that's the third time we've talked about community. Except that last week I at least ended it on a positive note, concluding that, hey, it's at least possible. Now, there are other things we've talked about that mix within different lectures, but basically I've managed to come up with a lot of unique themes, and a lot of them even which are quite revealing. Sometimes I would categorize them as revelations, or at least they were to me. Now, all right, we have this situation. We have this situation where there is this interesting form of having to come up with new things, coming to come up with things which are unique. But you could see this from one of two points of view. It could be that it's me who wishes to remain relevant. It's me who is gaining from this, who is finding something interesting to talk about because it's helpful for him. Or it's me who is trying to find something interesting for you, for your sake and for your benefit. Now, either way, I suppose it's okay as long as you like it. But let's take that second part. I would say it's me trying to speak about something which I have some understanding of, some experience of, and sharing it with you who actually wish to know about it. Now, that would require feedback. I would have to know from you what it is really that you want from these discussions. What it really is that you want. What it really is that I could offer to you that you would find valuable. Something that would really assist you in your life. Now, I have, of course, heard some forms of feedback. Sometimes people, they, of course, ask questions. And I try to answer these questions as best I can. Yet even the questions are petering out. Because you know all these things. The questions are reducing in the way in which they encompass broad themes. They basically are more detailed about specific items within a broad theme that somebody would like to discuss. And to a certain extent, this means there's a lot of intellectualization going on. There's a lot of analysis going on. A comparison between this kind of understanding and a comparison with that kind of understanding. A listing of what's possible, what's not. Detailed analysis of themes. So we have a lot of intellectualization. And the more that occurs, the more it becomes academic. In the sense that it becomes a manifestation or an expression of researched knowledge, of statistic, of lists, of organized outlines of things. It becomes, to a certain extent, like a course in the university, an academic discussion of very specific forms of, shall we say, intellectual ideas and concepts. That's unfortunate because it is not what I, in my realization of things, wished to convey. Yet if you think about it, over time, when you have to come up with something that the audience is going to be interested in, you have to get more and more detailed because that's with the way they move into the topic. Yet when you become more and more detailed, it becomes drier. It becomes less interesting. I even know from my previous times in ISKCON, where we have this enormous body of literature, hundreds of thousands of pieces of literature to read, to discuss, to talk about. Yet, to a large extent, people who would go to classes and discussions would sit there out of duty, because it would be a repetition of that which has already been heard a million times. And if the speaker happened to be inspired that day, maybe he could make it interesting. And we find that the more people write about it, the more it becomes an analytical arrangement, the more it becomes an analytical discussion, the more it becomes an intellectualization of concepts, and the more it becomes a discussion or an argumentation between one school of thought and another school of thought, one philosophical way of presenting it and another. In other words, it duplicates academia precisely. And we have again brahmanas who are simply arguing with each other to prove their point superior because they don't really have anything unique to say. So they have to squeeze out meaning from various little points here and there. And I feel that when a spiritual tradition or when an esoteric tradition is reduced to this form of regular discussion, it becomes destroyed. So then I'm wondering, what am I going to talk about? And I realize that my theme today is that all this struggle to talk about and all this talking about is a great way to ruin any good thing, where somebody might think that I'm dependent on hearing something on Saturday, otherwise my week doesn't go well. Or somebody might think that there's something here that might be fun. Or I'll just wait for that something unique. Yet, in my understanding of it, what really counts is that there is this energetic exchange, this energetic capturing of our essence, where there is a feedback of our essence, where we can have a very definitive experience of something spiritual. Now, of course, my week last week was not a good week at all. Things didn't go very well for me. I'm being forced to transform in various ways that I'm not very happy with. In other words, life is just going on as life. That's the way life is. And yet, at the same time, I understand that if everything I do is based on my personal realization, well, sometimes you're going to have to suffer here on Saturday because my personal realization right now is kind of little. I don't feel very inspired. I don't feel things that I'm able to give things very uniquely or in a very interesting way. And I realize that that which is based simply on inspiration also has its limitation. Like, for example, every musician knows. Like if you're playing with a group of others and you want to be inspired to just play spontaneously, you have to come up with some theme. If you don't have a theme, it's basically just free-form jazz, which is kind of could be chaotic, or which basically is a medium to express the virtuosity of musicians, where everybody in the background is kind of going to dap, bap, 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 and the virtuoso is going, and everybody listens and goes, hey, cool, really fast, really interesting. But you'll find nowadays that people aren't interested in that. That's why the whole jazz scene has moved into various directions where every single song has to have a very specific, organized theme. It has to be very structured. Maybe in the middle of it you can go wherever you want. But if you ever want to record stuff and you want to have any kind of following, you have to have something very structured that captures people's attention because of the structure of it. And to find unique structures like this, you have to go in the back room and you have to struggle to write them because it's really tough to come up with new themes. These little melodies are really tough to come up with because you've got hundreds of thousands of musicians out there who are writing all these little themes. And in the jazz world, because themes have to sound a certain way in according to the particular form, coming up with new themes is a big work. It can give you a big headache if you have to do it professionally. And if you're going to do things spontaneously, the only way you can get it to work spontaneously is to start off with some kind of a theme, maybe not well developed, but one that you can develop. For example, you have to have a rhythm that everybody can agree on. Not only that, but they have to understand it. Even more importantly, they have to feel it. Then somebody, doesn't matter who it is, has to start off in such a way as to define the key. So you're already defined by the rhythm and by the key. And then within that definition of the key, there is the establishment of some kind of a theme which can be expanded upon in the rest of the song. So you still have to have a theme. Okay, maybe it's not as uniquely expanded and repeated and put in a package as a composed theme. But you still have to have some kind of theme. Otherwise, the music sounds like chaotic, uninteresting, sometimes even nonsense. So everybody has this problem. There has to be something that you can grab on to. And so today I'm grabbing on to the fact that we are running out of things to talk about. Now, what does that mean? It could mean that the broadcasts are becoming irrelevant. It could mean that what I'm talking about has reached its end. It could be that you as a listener just don't really have interest to figure out more things. Or it could mean that you're just happy with me sitting here talking about anything I might babble about, just because you like me. But one day you might not, and then you'll say, hey, that's kind of useless. Then you might find that new people might join into these discussions. Then that puts me in a very difficult situation. For example, this has happened recently. Some kind of new crowd to a certain extent has developed in the audience. So now if you consider my point of view, I consider the development of the themes that we're talking about to have started back in 1999 when I first started speaking in St. Petersburg. And we recorded some things on tape. Some people bought those tapes, not so many, because we didn't really have a way to distribute them. And we couldn't mail tapes from Russia. That just didn't work. But nowadays we have this broad-based, web-based system, MP3 files. Anybody can get them. Anybody can download them. So, okay, the methodology to deliver the information has become very sophisticated and easy, convenient for everyone. But just consider my point of view. I have been developing whatever it is I've been talking about for the last 8 years. So it's, from my point of view, I think right now anyway, I'm probably wrong because there's always new things you can understand. But basically, I've come to the end of it. It's like a full cycle was reached. And whatever there was to like reveal in this particular context, because my context, of course, is the Eastern tradition context, especially the context with the Radha and Krishna deities or Lord Chaitanya, the different devas that are there. I'm very much rooted in that. And therefore, whatever revelation has been there has only been there in connection to these deities. I mean, ultimately, I am what I would define as a bhakta, not what would be defined as a bhakta by other traditions that even I have come from, because part of the revelation of what I've been speaking about is to explain about how there is a large amount of redundancy and irrelevant material, irrelevant concepts. There's been a lot of repetition, redundant points, and irrelevant concepts which are not related to we as people who live in the modern world. So I've been like trying to work to correct what I feel is not relevant and therefore not compatible with people now, and try to make it more relevant and more compatible to us as living entities, so that the ultimate essence and goal, which is this unique connection we have to Radha and Krishna, unique connection we have to all things within this creation, the essence of what we are becomes manifested. So that is my always and constant underlying motivation. That is really what I'm all about. Now, that I have, I must say, developed up to whatever point I felt needed to be developed to assist anybody to make that transition, if they had been in such a tradition before, to something which perfectly, I would say, of course I can't say perfectly, which very functions very well, okay, to meld, to marry the Eastern tradition with the present consciousness of modern man. I feel there's a lot of material available in these lectures. There's a lot of material available in already to download and so forth, which actually accomplishes this purpose. Now, that's just my opinion. I feel that because I was the one speaking it and I had these ideas and I had to formulate it, so in my mind, I feel that basically it's already there. Maybe some small revelations might be there in very specific issues, or a clarification of something you might have read in some Vedic literature, which makes the light bulb go off with aha, might be there. But honestly speaking, there's a whole kind of a package available. So if a newer group of people comes, and that's what's happening, I'm finding this overlapping, they will want something which is similar to what has already been there. So I'll have to go back and repeat. I'll have to go back and again go through things which you've already heard. And because there isn't like a lot to talk about which is new and unique, for the people who've been there steadily through the years, this will be something which is repetitive and which will fall in the category of something which is, to a certain extent, an intellectual concept now because it's been discussed so much, which is not relevant to the evolutionary advancement you have attained at the present moment. And that makes me lament very much. Because here I am stuck. Somehow I've got to take now new people to a platform where everybody already is. And yet at the same time, I am so totally committed to you people who have been taking part in this exchange for years now. You have no idea how committed I am to you because of this this like connection we have. I wouldn't call it loyalty because it's not loyalty. Loyalty is something which even implies a kind of mindlessness. You know, like if you're mindlessly loyal to something, you think of dogs being loyal to their masters. It's not really a kind of a, it's not the kind of a concept which is very glorious. So therefore, it is not a question of loyalty. It's not a question of supporting me, because I don't feel that either. It's a question of connection. It's a question of deep connection, which has arisen through our sharing of this exploratory research, this experimentation with pushing the limits of what has been known as spirituality in the past, of integrating that within this very beautiful understanding of Radha and Krishna and Lord Chaitanya and the beautiful devas who are there connected to us, the way in which we are all connected to each other, the way in which this whole creation is connected within that matrix that is there, that has been energized by Radha and Krishna, which is their energy. So this kind of like sharing of the development of this is such a magnificent thing. What we have is magnificent. It is not something that can be duplicated. It's not something that you can just pick somebody up from somewhere and put them in the middle of it and they become part of it. I don't mean to say that nobody new can listen and they can't listen to lectures, and I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying, that which actually is the essence of what we are, has been developed together. Because I'm not foolish enough to think that I have come up with something. What revelation that I may have shared is something I have gotten, but not only from like the upwards direction. It's something I've gotten from you, as much as you are getting from me. You know the speaker audience thing, you know that very well. The audience creates the speaker. The audience creates the band, in a sense. That energy which exchanges between them gives that life which makes things work. So we have that sharing. We are sharing this. We are sharing this. And this sharing is very integral to what it is that we are doing. And that cannot be duplicated. It's just something that took place over time. It's a historical fact. And for me, I'm not really interested to have to repeat again in this live format that which I have already gone through with everyone and evolved together with everyone. You understand? From my point of view, we have evolved this together. We have experienced this together. So if I have to now go back and just repeat things for others, it doesn't work for me. I suppose I could do it if I had to walk in a room and I knew everybody in here was a newbie, as they're called. New kind of people. They may have had their understandings from whatever books they read or whatever traditions. They may even be very advanced. But I know they don't have that which makes what we do very unique. And therefore, with great pleasure, I can speak with them. Because it will be a new development together. But it's very hard to do that when you're together with those people who have been intimately involved in what you have done from the very beginning, basically. And therefore, I find it difficult now when I sit here. Because as I've said, there are no more new topics to talk about, at least not right now, that I can think of. You are also quite satiated. I know it from the questions. I know it from the lack of topics being asked to me. And you already know most of all these things. You know it well. You live it. When I speak it, you just go, yeah, yeah, we know that stuff. And then if I have to repeat, go backwards and repeat for the sake of somebody new, I'm going to interfere with that relationship we have. You understand my particular difficulty. I would rather not have a lecture format and just talk with you. But then we have this enormous problem, not even technically, because technically I could arrange it so that we could have a chat. If I paid, let's say, an extra $30 a month, I could have a flash-based video audio chat going on with 4 or 6 people at once, and we could discuss things and probably come up with a lot of very interesting points. But the problem we face in these discussions is the translation. This only works in an environment where everybody speaks the same language. And I don't have that environment. I have the environment where I don't speak the main language that everybody else speaks. And it's very difficult for one translator to translate a group of people, because speaking like I speak requires a skill. I mean, not like it's a very complicated skill, but I'm listening to what Sudhadani's saying as I'm speaking, and if I hear that he's stuck, I'll just wait until he catches up. Or if I know he doesn't understand, I'll speak to him about it. I won't talk too fast. I'll make pauses. I'll try not to use words which I know he doesn't know. But I'm becoming contaminated living in this country, America. I'm starting to use idioms. And just like I said, newbie, that's an idiom. But because Sudo's an internet guy, he probably knows what a newbie is. So I allowed my... Did you? Okay, he knew that one. Yeah. But there were others who... Other idioms I used that I know he didn't know, and I had to immediately correct myself. But people who would talk in a chat format who speak English would speak in a way that he couldn't translate. And it would ruin the whole thing. So to a certain extent, I'm stuck. When I was actually there in Russia physically, it was actually pretty cool for me, especially in Moscow. Those lectures are available. You can hear the interaction with the audience, the way in which the audience and I were directly feeding off of each other. We're sharing with each other. We're joking with each other. You know, I'm a real joker at heart. I don't know if you know that, but I love doing comedy routines and joking and having everybody laughing. Because a lot of life is hysterically funny. I mean, things we take so incredibly seriously are not serious at all. They're hysterical. If you take a step back and look at it, it's like hysterical if you think about it. And so when I'm in a live format, I'm able to speak about this and laugh with everybody. And I can immediately see what's catching your attention. And I can increase that, you see. But when we're in this format, that interaction's not there. So we are restricted. We are restricted to what we can talk about. And it has to a certain extent, have relevance to you. But I know. I'm not going to call for, please send me suggestions what to talk about. I'm not going to call, send me questions. Because I know you're very satiated. As entities who have been going through this process of evolution, you are satiated. You know what you're doing. Okay, I didn't say you were successful at doing it. I'm not successful at doing it either. What does successful mean anyway? What does success mean? And then we start talking about this absurd concept of having attained success, having attained what? Then we start using words like perfection, siddhis, having attained. And then we get to the idea, well, if there is something to attain, if there is some success, then there are those people who are successful. Because obviously, if there is something to attain, there must be, we assume, people who have already attained it. Otherwise, how would we know that such an attainment is possible? And then we have our heroes. We have our acharyas, our heroes, those who have attained, those who have come to success. But in reality, we never feel like that. We always feel personally, we are not successful. I feel like that too. And you know what? I guarantee you, of course, I have no way to prove it. It's just my opinion, born of my experience and knowledge of various heroes. I've known a lot of heroes. That nobody feels that they've attained it. Nobody feels they're successful. Now, we may look at others and say, well, they're a lot more attained than I am. Of course, that's okay. We can have mentors, those who help us come to the platform of attainment. I am basically a mentor. A mentor is just somebody who helps you get somewhere that you want to get to. But that doesn't mean I'm there. Because first of all, where you want to get to is not necessarily where I want to get to. And besides, the idea that there is a absolute place to get to is not compatible to what I think or feel. So, therefore, I don't know what anybody would say if they were to say he's successful, he's attained. I wouldn't know how to relate to that. Because even if you've attained, you still have to live. And life is a complex network of things. Life is a complex network of relationships. Life is a complex network of evolutionary challenges and obstacles that every single person has to face. Having said that, there is something which is greater than us, something which is a constant, something which is more important than our everyday desires to attain something. Obviously, that's Radha and Krishna, that's Gaur and Nithai, that's the devas everywhere who are so much a part of our lives, yet we don't even care about them sometimes or think about them. There are the people who are right next to us. There are those people who we don't even know about, but who are affecting us so seriously in everything we do. There are these situations which arise, some sent by the universe, some sent by the world, some sent by friends or some sent by enemies, some created by ourselves, all of which are greater than us as individuals. So there is this constant necessity to interact, and there is this wonderful opportunity always, whether you are attained or not, whether you are successful or not, whether or not you know things and can analyze things or are academically qualified or not. And that is this connection to God. Okay, this word God, it's a boring word. It brings about all kinds of Christian concepts or Jewish concepts or Islamic concepts or, but it's a great categorical concept. And it includes everything godly. Because godly means it's of God. That's the definition of the word godly. So when we're talking about God, we talk about these wonderful personalities. And what's most interesting is there is no attaining. It's the connecting. It's the interacting. It's the relationship. That's what I was talking about in relation to us. This discussion on Saturday is not about attaining. It's not about me attaining a new, interesting, unique topic. Because that's already happened. It's not about me even making you laugh doing a show, because that's limited according to the medium that we are using here. Although that's not limited when we're face to face. What it really is this constant connection, this constant relationship, this constant sharing, and this constant essence of what we are as us. And this is something which you have similarly, we all have similarly, in relationship to our deities, in relationship to their lordships, in relationship to all those wonderful personalities with whom we share existence. And this is a non-stop, continuous relationship. A non-stop, continuous interaction, which transcends all kinds of talk, all kinds of concepts, all kinds of lists and details. Because all of these concepts and lists and details and things are meant simply to bring you to the interaction. For one who's got that interaction with the divine, these things become less interesting. And then they tend to discuss what they have in their interaction for the sake of those who don't have the interaction, so they can develop the interaction. And that's where selfless sharing comes in. The bringing others together into an awareness and an advanced stage of consciousness whereby they may also experience the interaction with the divine, with Radha and Krishna. So it's a dilemma. And yet this dilemma is a very important dilemma. If you look at history, again, I'm being analytical. If you look at the greatest technological advancements that have taken place, they have taken place due to war. Communications was very, very primitive before, in around 1840 even. Up 1840, you had no connection between continents. There was, of course, telegraph. They had developed electricity. They really didn't know what to do with electricity, except to make it go on and off with the telegraph. And that would make the telegraph on the other side, when it went down here, it went up there, and it went beep, 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 and making letters that way. But that could only be done when there was a possibility to stretch a wire. And then they tried to lay this wire across the Atlantic and it failed. But then the Civil War came in America. And the importance of communication was amplified 100 times. And because of that, a whole new communications empire started to develop, and they did lay a cable across the Atlantic and had communication ever since. World War I saw an enormous increase in aeronautics, in airplanes, in the development of the first kind of tanks and weapons of enormous destruction through armored vehicles, not tanks, but of shooting weapons, shooting bullets fast, of dropping bombs even, where they figured out how to drop bombs out of airplanes. This was an enormous advancement. And then after that, there was an incredible boost in the whole world's economy, which then caused a crash. Then came World War II, and all of a sudden, enormous strides were made. If you look at the beginning of World War II, the technology in the airplanes, in tanks, in bombs, in radar, in communication, in encryption of messages, as compared to the end of World War II, well, you only have to look at the development of rockets, the development of the atom bomb, the development basically of these very sophisticated forms of airplanes and radar and communications. By the time we get to the Korean War, we got jet aircraft really taking off at this time. And we see every time there is this struggle, this problem, this conflict, it forces the advancement out of necessity of the development of technology to meet the need. So that means our own advancement, I mean, I'm using this as a parallel, is assisted by our meeting obstacles, our meeting conflict, our meeting a war, let's say war with boredom, war with anxiety, war with health, war with economics, war with our living situation. This will force us to evolve, because you can be however attained and as successful as you want, but when you meet the real world in any way, even if you are some attained yogi, attained swami or whatever, and you meet real people who have real problems, you're going to find that your attainment is seriously tested, because you're going to have to interact with people, make their evolution part of your evolution, to make that which they require, what you require to have for them. You have to mentor them, but to do that, you have to know what they need. You have to know what they are. You have to feel what they feel. Otherwise, you cannot succeed. You can't just repeat some words or even come up with a fancy way of saying the same thing. Because ultimately, after a while, people have the same problems everywhere. Doesn't matter if they're safely protected in a sect or they're in the real world. They have the same format of problems. Economic problems, how to get money. Economic problems, how to spend money. Economic problems, how to secure money. Keep it safe. How to manage it. How to prevent exploitation, theft, misuse of funds. And then political problems. How to defend yourself against other influences. How to deal with interpersonal difficulties. How to deal with sickness. How to deal with others who don't really care about the fact that you're sick. How to deal with love, the need to be loved, the absolute human requirement to love. How to deal with all of these things which everybody, everywhere, no matter who they are, no matter what they have attained, shares as the needs of life, the obstacles all of us in life have to face. Therefore, there's no use talking about attainment. There's no use talking about success. Doesn't matter what you are, who you are, what situation you're in. You share this series of experiences while you are here. And it is these series of experiences which propel us forward. Because all that exists ultimately is right now, which is a series of present moments which are just continually occurring without cessation, which is that ever-present existence. So all we can do is live. I love it when some people say, well, I'd rather just die. And you think it'll be different? Wherever you are, this is basic spirituality, that same you is going to have the same exact, and I mean exact, set of difficulties. The same you, I'm going to repeat that, is going to have the same exact set of difficulties. Okay, sure. You may not have a fat body. You may have a skinny body. Because you're lamenting, I'm too fat. All right, you'll be skinny. But the same you with those really basic problems, because being fat is not the problem. The problem is what you perceive is the difficulty with the fatness, the inability to associate with others, or the inability to be appreciated for what you are, and so on. That has a lot more to do with what you are as a person than it has to do with the way you are in a physical body. One realizes that when the fat becomes skinny, but they're the same people, just skinnier. When the poor become richer, they're the same people, just richer. And they have basically the same problems. In fact, sometimes it's even worse. Somebody who is poor but happy, you give them a lot of money, their lives can be ruined. I don't want to start throwing examples at you. There's plenty of winners of the lottery who know this very well, who ultimately say, this was the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life. It's amazing. Sometimes we just wish our whole lives for something. And when we get it, we sometimes think, boy, that really wasn't worth it, was it? And that's why Joni Mitchell sang that beautiful song, you don't know what you got till it's gone. Huh? Dig up the garden, put a parking lot there. Cut down the trees, put up a parking lot. It's like, ultimately, life experiences are about us as people. And ultimately, all that carries us as people through life is our experiences with the world, which are mainly concerned with experiences with others. And according to the way we are as people, those experiences with others take a certain form or shape and dimension. And our evolution goes on through that. Yet the constant throughout all of this is ourselves, are the others, and are their lordships who hold it all together and remain there always, intimately connected with us through every single cell of our existence. And if we maintain a vision of that, we never become bewildered. If we maintain a vision of what really has value, what really is important, we never become bewildered by it. That doesn't mean we'll be happy all the time. That's a silly concept. But it means we will understand the essence of it. And therefore, whether there's happiness or distress, or there's disturbance or not, success or failure, we can maintain a certain kind of consistency, which is a commitment to the now, a commitment to experiencing, a commitment to our being, and ultimately to our evolution as living entities. So I hope that all of us can understand our situation from this back-ended way I entered into this discussion, you know, moving into it through the back end and coming out the front. Almost like you could start this lecture off at the end of it and just play it backwards and then there you are. But yet everything I have said is very relevant. I mean, how relevant it is, I can't say. To me, it seemed relevant anyway. I've had a lot of interesting interchanges here on instant messages, some of them practical and some of them philosophical. I can share. I like the dilemma here that one of our very regular members, shall we say, he's bringing up the point that, let me edit his point and bring it to a question of definition. I see this is often a real problem that we have in discussions, is that we're not exactly clear about a common usage of a term. In other words, we may use a term, we may speak about a term where a certain understanding of it is accepted, which may not actually refer to the term itself. And I'd like to share something. I bought Garuda's translation of the Bhagavad Gita. I have it, just got it yesterday. Graham Schweig, his new Bhagavad Gita. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get things like this. And it's truly a fabulous rendition of the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, some scholars were saying on the back of the cover that it'll be a long time, if ever, that anyone manages to surpass this rendition in English. And another person said that just as the Gita itself is a classic in Indian tradition, this translation is a classic. And I think it's very cool about the way he has struggled with the definition of words. For example, in one verse, I don't have it in front of me, so it's hard to immediately give you the whole thing with it. But the word being came up. Now, being can be a verb. It can be used as an in various forms, but it can also be a noun. Usually people translate that verse with being as a verb or an object, but he uses it as a noun. Now, I didn't know that until I read the footnote, because I was eating breakfast and reading this, and I was reading this verse and thinking, you know, people, I think, have misunderstood the meaning of this being, because the only way you can understand this verse is if you think of being as a noun. In other words, being, me, I'm a being. I'm a living entity, a being. Rather than being as in existing or something like that. And then I look in the footnote and he did the same thing. And that brought up a whole new understanding for me. So I felt it was very significant when real scholars struggle with definitions, because if we speak, we use words, and words are intended to convey concepts, and to properly convey the concept, we have to agree on the definitions of the words we use. So, our questioner here is struggling with the definition of the word realize. Now, realize has many forms, as all words do. We could talk about it as a verb, to realize, which is a process of gradually realizing something. Like you can realize your plan, or you are in the process of realizing your plan, or you're trying to develop realization, which implies you are realized, which means that you have already come to a realization, and that is a state of realized. Now, the way I'm presenting it is obviously part of the Eastern tradition, is that there is never a moment where you are completely, finally, finished with all, realized. You are always in a state of attaining realization, greater realization. You are trying to understand more, trying to develop more. That's natural. So that state of attaining realization is a healthy state. It's the way in which life is going on. We understand something. We realize something through our experience. But that's not the end. Life is not a movement towards a state of either being or realization or whatever. Life is constantly moving. Life is constantly transforming. So the idea that you end up somewhere, this is a very convenient goal. It's convenient to talk about. It encourages people to go from here to there. Now you are not realized, but at one point you will be realized. In other words, it gives this illusion that somewhere, not here maybe in Vaikuntha, maybe in Goloka, or maybe even here, if you are a very special person, and if you are such a very special person, then we should worship you to get mercy and develop your realization, which you will imprint upon us in the heart. So that realization means you are there. You've got it. You've attained it. You are there. Now, this idea is contradictory to the very definition of spirit, because spirit is alive. Spirit is, and life is never static. Life never comes to a point at which there's no change, at which there's no transformation, at which there's no growth. One of the definitions of life is growth. If there is none, there's no life. So the very definition of life is contradictory to this definition of having attained it. So I would say that life is a series of the word realize in its verb form, to realize, undergoing processes where you realize more and more, and the noun form where you have become realized. But this realized state is just little plateaus or little resting places along the path of life where you realize this and you realize that and you realize the other thing, but you've got to keep on going because you can't stop. Even if you wanted to stop and say, okay, I've realized, nowhere else to go, it doesn't work like that. Because life pushes you. Life demands motion, growth. So you can never have this static state where everything is finalized. It does not exist. Now, when we create such states philosophically, it is because they are useful for discussing with certain people. It allows us to have a movement from here to there. And it allows all people who are surrounding that usually, quote unquote, realized person. Now, I'm not saying quote unquote realized because I think the person has no realization. Not at all. Usually they are very advanced people in some form or another. But I say quote unquote because the idea of the followers is often they've got it. And therefore often these realized quote unquote people have to propagate the idea that they are actually in knowledge, they've actually got it, they have that realization, because otherwise they lose their people, or the people they've got become difficult to deal with, because the illusory relationship between the two is almost as if there's one who doesn't make mistakes and one who makes mistakes. One who doesn't know and one who knows. One who needs help and one who can give help. So this idea is something we create. It's a very handy, useful idea which allows us to have all kinds of dependencies develop. Yet at the same time, again, it's a very handy idea because it allows us to move from here to there. And because there's that realized person, everybody has the same center to point towards. Now, I know the center is actually God. I know that. And I know that these realized persons do point you towards God. Yet, we have to see it as if there's this circle around a person, and all are pointing towards this other circle called God. It's not that this circle is a bunch of personalities all pointing to God. In reality, you've got this circle around one personality, and together they point to God. This is a difficult situation because to maintain that circle, you've got to maintain certain ideas as if this person in the center has certain amounts of realization. Another person, not the one who I'm talking about now, has mentioned that in these Eastern traditions, meditation on gurus or meditation on these realized persons is supposed to be a very good way to develop yourself spiritually. But again, I say, this is an artificial construction which makes a complex situation even more complex, not simpler. In fact, one could even say the situation is quite simple, but it is made complex by sticking somebody between you and your realization or the Supreme or whatever you want to call it. Now, of course, we could debate that point, and I have done so in other discussions, so I won't do that here. But the difficulty the original questioner has is that he has admitted to being captured in a previous understanding. Now, that is very significant that he states that word captured. And I think that's very significant. He used the word captured because in reality, when you have to accept this package, you in essence become captured by the package. And to break out of that, you have to take yourself out of the package and examine each element within the package individually. Practically like you would open a box and look at everything and then say, well, that doesn't work in there and that's useless, or that's okay, you can stay. And now I know that's very, some people might even call it arrogant, how you are determining what is best for you. They call it arrogant. They say, you can't do that. Those who are superior will do it for you. That's the way, of course, you deal with children. And of course, parents are useful. But parents also don't have to be dictators. They can be mentors. Mentors who help you understand what you are and what you can know. So this idea that there is a state, that there is a place, that there is a goal, and there are those who are realized, is a very convenient way of discussing the manner in which you move from where you are now to where you think you want to be. But it's not so in reality. But it's okay to have that direction at one point. It's useful. But once you're there at the realized, you realize you're still not there, because there is no there. There's life. There's relationship. There's more to realize. Maybe what you have to realize is to let go and have some fun. It's hard to say, you know? I mean, life is complex. Life is difficult. Now, of course, I know we have created this concept of the perfect spiritual world where everything is just peachy. And maybe it really is so. But I'm more or less dealing with us right here and right now. And I don't think it helps us, at least not when we are functioning as humans, to use this idea of realized. I think it is in the sense of that this person is there. I think it's dangerous. It's dangerous for us, and it's even more insidiously dangerous for that person. Because I've seen a lot of psychological damage in that sense, emotional damage in that sense, physical damage even to their own bodies. I mean, it's a difficult situation. Anyway, I hope that I have shed some light on that. I don't know if it has. Let me know. I've gotten a lot of letters from newbies. I'm sorry to use that term. It's a really disgusting term, because nobody's a newbie when it comes to spiritual life. And I only meant it in terms of, you know, been around listening all along. Now, okay, I said it, so I'm guilty. I know that I'm the guy who said it, and I have to take responsibility for it. Okay. But of course there's more to that, and I'd like to explain it. Like, for example, people say I don't have to repeat things over again and so on, and that some people are assuming, yeah, we got the point already, it's okay. I mean, in one way or another. But that's not what I was referring to. What I was referring to were the esoteric practices, the mystical practices, which we have shared. And it's these mystical things, it's these esoteric things, which I feel give the real keys to this relationship, to this contact. And that is very hard to go back and do over again. And I would be very upset if somebody were to miss out on that. Therefore, maybe lectures, meditations that are recorded could be of use. It says, looks like one day everything becomes clear. There's no more questions remaining. Consciousness is jumping to higher and higher levels. becoming more and more free and more expanding and looks like no more recipes which will work for everybody, just personal vision and feeling. Even the conceptions of God are not very important, because more important is to travel in one's own unlimited consciousness. Well, yes and no. Yeah, sure. Yes, sometimes. And yes, as long as you live in the world and as long as you are in relationship with other people, periodically you will be forced, and I mean that word very seriously, forced to limit what you do, forced to limit and become entangled somehow or another in being of service. And you could take that as a pleasure or not. It depends on your consciousness. It depends on how you see things. And therefore, you may or may not feel the same freedom, or you may or may not feel the same elation that you might feel when you are in an extraordinary state of expansive spirituality. So therefore, I say yes and no to that comment, but it's a great comment. Here I've got another question. Considering what I just said about people who lead you from A to B, because it's very useful and handy, does it mean they are somewhat negatively motivated? Do they have a negative motivation which causes them to become interested and attracted to simply creating an A, point A to point Z methodology by which you are here and you end up over there? Is that born of some kind of negative form of motivation? Is there some kind of negative feeling within them or some kind of negative idea? Again, yes and no. It would be if somebody was saying what they were saying because they were using that as a means to exploit you. If they found a way to get something out of you, using that as an excuse, then definitely, yes. But you'd have to see that in each and every case. And again, you'd have to see what is going on, which is very difficult. I mean, how would you know that somebody does what they do because they just want either money out of you or support out of you or to be glorified by you or to be in a high position because of your following them or something like that, or to gain power from you because you have numbers, many numbers of you are there? You really don't know. It's very hard to see that. Because then you're dealing with somebody's motivation. And it's very hard to judge motivation. You can see symptoms of it. And you can therefore become a little discouraged by those symptoms that you might see. But for those who are captured in that way, making a clean break is very difficult. Because you would have to admit to yourself that you believe this person had motivations which were not good. But then again, there's an alternative to that. You could at least say, this person did not really understand completely the implications of presenting things in such a way. So that's another way to look at it, that they were not aware of the broader consequences of this idea. So that means their motivation wasn't bad, because they really felt this was going to help. But it's only because they just weren't aware enough to understand the long term, or rather the bigger picture implications of what they did. But then again, to see it like that, you're going to have to take your human demigods and make them human. And to understand that what was very realized perhaps some years ago is the tip of the further realization presently. In other words, they tried their best and you're moving forward. So you wouldn't call them bad motivated, but again, you would distance yourself from being captured by such persons because you realize they are not perfect in that sense that we thought, or realized in the sense that you thought, that meaning the final destination, because there's more to it. So again, bad motivation, negative motivation, you have to see these things in context. And then again, you may have somebody who creates this idea that you move from this point to that point because it's very useful for you. Let's take a educational system, for example. You start off in point A in the first grade of the school, and you end up with a paper, a degree from the university that says you have completed the course of knowledge. You know that which we have prepared to teach, and you are prepared to enter into this profession or discipline and go with these blessings. So that is also a beginning and a destination. And the day you walk out of there with your certificate, you may actually think you've got it. And those people who are, let's say, freshmen in college, the first grade of college, may look at you and say, they've got it. They've done it. They are there. And I want to get there. So in that point, in that way of looking at it, it's very useful to have a beginning and an end. And that's not at all a negative motivation. It's for the sake of helping people. And I think that's a very important point. Interesting here, somebody commented that encouraging me, I mean, of course, I need encouragement. I'm a person after all. Telling me to go on. It's good to do what you're doing. And that I should just go on and do what I feel is right when I sit here to talk. Because the comment was, Radha Krishna are using you, isn't it? Well, let's talk about that. How would you know? If listening to me is important to you because you feel that Radha and Krishna are using me, well, that is different than if Radha and Krishna are actually doing so. In other words, it's your need to believe that, which is an important motivation to continue listening. Now, if you ask me, isn't it? Like, in other words, Radha and Krishna are using you. Isn't it? Now you're putting me in the position where I have to confirm your motivation. Now, if I were to say, no, they're not using me, then I would lose you as a listener. I would be in the position of being forced to tell you that actually I am divinely inspired. Radha and Krishna are using me like a puppet, and I am dancing according to their desires, because that would maintain my mystique. I would then have a mystique. I would be this guy who's got this charisma, this mystique, this anyone. We know we don't have to put commas, or I mean quotation marks around it and say realize, because we know that beyond realization, anyone who is being used by Radha and Krishna must be that totally realized person. even beyond. I mean, it's like fantastic the way we put these requirements on people. Can you imagine how difficult it would be for me in my life if I had to maintain this idea that Radha and Krishna are using me? Now, okay, I get inspired, no doubt. I hear things, okay, I admit it. I feel things, sure. I think I may be getting some communication from that divine realm, okay. But never, please, I beg of you, put me in the situation where I have to confirm to you that I am being used by Radha and Krishna. First of all, even if I were to say so, why should you believe it? Second of all, how would I even know? I mean, honestly speaking, I mean, you can listen and say, wow, that's really inspired. That's all that counts. And if I feel inspired, that's fine. But don't ask me to enter into this like really ridiculous necessity to be something other than this person who sits here and talks and shares whatever inspiration may be there. Okay, I have been corrected that this was not what was meant, and that actually what was meant to be a channel for inspiration. And yes, I can accept that. Yes, that's great. I like that. If I can channel some inspiration to you, that's fine. But I am not a channeler. Even if I hear something, I don't just channel it. I am an intimate part of this, whatever it is I express. I'm taking responsibility for these expressions. There's assistance, there's help. Things may flow through me that even I was not aware I could say. But it's not just channeling. I will always be part of this, probably the majority part. And I take responsibility for the mistakes, and I take responsibility for misunderstandings. And that's very important to understand. I just never want to be placed in the situation of having to be more than what I am. I also very much dislike being less than what I am. And when somebody tries to place me in a situation of being less than what I am, I get not only upset, but I rebel against it. Or I may just walk away from that situation. But I am similarly unhappy with having to be made more than what I am. Because the only thing I like is to be what I am. Nothing more, nothing less. And I wish to know that about you, what you are, nothing more, nothing less. And I request that others know what I am, nothing more, nothing less. That's like the basis of human respect.